Hello!
Welcome to Movie Banter.
This is the first podcast, the rest of Paul's Knife.
Exactly, in a new studio. After last week's moving special, which was not because it was...
It was emotionally traumatic.
It was, wasn't it? We really, you know, talked about rat race in some very emotional ways there. But no, it was especially about me moving house. So now we're in a new studio slash room.
Yes. Well, it is quite studio-esque.
It's quite
studio-esque. This is your new study.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. So hopefully work will be done here. And this is the first bit of work to be done here, which is not really work. It's a podcast.
Well, sort of work and play.
Sort of work. It is. It's the two-thirds of a Mars bar.
It's a job that's also a hobby.
Exactly. It's a jobby. So, welcome to Movie Banter. Oh, I'm Paul Carenza.
I am John Sands.
And, yes, this is an introduction.
Brilliant. Well done.
We want really, shouldn't we?
we're thrown by the new room.
I know. I am. So we're going to talk about some films this week, such as The Boat That Rocked.
Which apparently very much doesn't.
The Boat That Sucked.
Yeah.
Big time. I shall be ranting a proper about that. And also, I saw Knowing and Duplicity.
I've been catching up on older films TV and DVD. Things like Superman Returns.
Very nice.
And The Imposter, which is a random sci-fi film I'd not heard of.
Okay.
And other films as well.
Well, we shall be getting onto these shortly. So your emails we shall now kick off with, although we are toying with having it maybe at the end of the show, so if you would prefer your emails later on, or even after the show finishes, if you don't like them at all, we'll just read them off air.
Yes. I just want to say thank you to people who've emailed in with other comments that we don't necessarily either get to on air or don't actually have that much to say about, but we appreciate your emails. And I still keep not writing back to people.
We're getting swamped. We're getting swamped by an email land now. So thank you, actually.
But if you've emailed us and not had a reply, then partly we have got it. Well, I assume we've got it. There may be emails we're not getting.
Exactly. Yes.
Chances are we have got it. But apologies for not writing back. But I will endeavour to start writing back.
We shall and we will.
Yes. You are not ignored. You are much appreciated.
Much valued. But keep emailing us anyway.
Yes.
And we shall continue to maybe or maybe not read yours out.
Yes.
But here's one we shall read out. This is from Jed in Singapore, who says, thank you for your review of Knowing, Mr. John Sands, and thank you in advance for my review of Knowing, which I shall now give.
He might not thank you for it.
It's all right. there you go. That was good.
Yeah.
No, I quite enjoyed it, actually.
Not surprising. I was intrigued as to which way you go. I figured it was one you could go either way on.
Well, I thought it was quite silly. I enjoyed it with reservations.
It's fairly preposterous.
I think I probably didn't enjoy it as much as you did.
Right.
I gave it a 7 out of 10 sort of thing. I liked the fact that it had the courage of its convictions to end in the way it went to end without ruining anything. But yeah, I did think it was a bit silly along the way.
It is, but I don't mind silly. But it's silly, madness. It's sort of driven silliness. It sets out with an idea and thinks, right, this is the idea, we're going to get behind it and see it through
to
the end.
Fair play to that. It just things like, ooh, Black Pebbles, ooh. You're trying to plant some sort of sinister thing, and then it wasn't really capitalised on hugely. It was just a bit odd.
No, okay, that's a fair point.
Things like that, but and I'm ruining nothing here because this is all in the trailer. Why do the numbers run out? And you know why? What happens? It stops here, and then what happens? We don't know. And in the prologue bit, you've got this girl who's madly writing down his numbers, and then putting it in a time capsule, and then they bury it and all that. And yeah, the teacher says time's up and takes a bit of paper away. So I'm there yelling at the screen. He's saying, but why have the numbers run out? I'm going, well, it's because she just ran out of time. She probably had more numbers to write. Don't worry about it. And it turns out it's not that at all. But no, so I was slightly thinking they sort of, you know, for a good half hour or so, he's worrying about something that wasn't really the case there.
Well, a little bit. But then we know there's more to come. Because we see her sort of scratching on the door. And
true.
And I did try to say more.
It was also highly convenient that Nicolas Cage goes against logic, I think, in that wherever it says there's going to be some sort of disaster, he rushes to the centre of it and goes, I've got to be there!
Exactly, that's very true. And it's convenient, they're all, well, the few we see are kind of man-made related issues, rather than, you know, a meteorite hitting. In which case, he's like, I'm going to be here, I'm going to try and stop, oh dear. And then gets hit in the
face. Actually, he knows he can't stop these things, and yet he always thinks, but I don't know, it seems like I just have to be there, and if we don't, then we're going against...
Then that's the point he raises about sort of determinism or randomism, in terms of, is it stuff that is predestined and it's going to happen regardless? Or is it that it's stuff that's happening and you can fix it by getting involved? You know it's happening. Can you stop it from happening? And well, he believes the latter, but then we see that's actually not the case.
I don't know. I suppose, yeah, yeah. If my criticism raises philosophical arguments, I suppose that's not really criticism. It's a talking point. So,
well, but it's a difference of opinion. I can see why it's not. I think it's a different thing.
Yes.
If you got a big list of disasters, or if I had a big list of disasters, say something horrible is going to happen here, I'd stay away from there personally.
Yeah.
But he's the kind of person who partly...
He's a man on a mission.
Yeah, I think
he's an action star.
Partly he's intrigued by this list of numbers, and he wants to sort of almost see it for himself. But also, I think he'd like to think that if he wants, what's the point of getting this list if it's not meant to be a warning? You know, you get turned up, you can stop this thing happening.
True. Jed does ask, is it strictly DVD viewing, or is it worth laying down money at the Cineplex? So I would argue DVD viewing. I'll catch it in the Cineplex if you can, by all means.
Yeah, I think it's.
But I wouldn't say it's essential for cinema.
No, it's not essential. But there are a few good large scale effects
those
in there.
Are right.
But it's not a massively effects driven thing.
Though, the CGI I thought was a bit ropey.
Really?
Yeah, just certain bits of it, and they're going, not right, but.
No, that didn't strike me at all.
Okay.
No, especially the first accident, which was one long camera shot with stuff going on around it.
Yeah.
I thought it was quite
all right, but then you've got there are moments of that you think that. CGI was definitely showing there.
No,
you can
okay.
see the work. And also, animals on fire running through a forest.
No, again, it didn't grate with me at all.
Yes.
And the animals on fire, by the way, is a dream sequence rather than one of the disasters.
That's all it is.
In case people think
we're
right,
just animals on fire for an hour and a half.
It's kind of like Disney on Ice. But slightly more
animals
wrong.
On fire.
Oh dear.
Sequel to Man on Fire.
Well, yeah. Sort of scaling it up slightly.
Exactly.
Jed also says about the clean rating, which, yeah, is the point we raised recently.
Balls to him.
Sorry. Charming.
You try and keep talking, see what I did.
Yes, Jed says about the clean rating.
Who are you? I'm only saying the light stuff, you see. We can still get away with the clean.
Sorry, this is a point we raised a week or two ago. Mm. He said, I'd rather you keep it that way and just slide in occasional innuendo, which is almost an innuendo in itself.
It is. Anything to do with sliding in innuendo.
Oh, yeah. So, like the lovely tentacle stuff in episode 20. Say lovely tentacle stuff. That's a little bit disturbing.
It's not about a lovely tentacle. It was about tentacle, and he says it was lovely.
Yes.
That's the difference.
Well,
fair
enough. Could be my lovely tentacle. It could be some sort of show there.
Lovely tentacle. smile.
Yes. Oh, the three.
Spot the reference, kids.
Yes. It turns out the clean rating thing, because I thought when we first set this up, there was kind of a definite clean rating, which is the wholesome, family-friendly thing.
Yes.
It turns out that's actually not. There are three versions. There's explicit, which is just pure filth. There's clean, which is if it was explicit and you've bleeped it out and edited it down and tidied it up.
Okay.
And then there's just kind of a normal podcast, which is
normal.
Just whatever you like. And we're in that
That's
normal
nice
category, because we're not explicit, but nor are we bleeped out. So there'll be no torrents of filth spewing out of your MP3 player or computer or anything. But we may...
You're safe here. Don't worry, Padre.
I'm sorry? I'm
trying to spit like a Western, but it's not working.
Oh, see. Why like a Western?
I don't know. It just sounds cool. Call people Padre, you will sound cool. That's the rules.
Yeah, we're here in the suburbs of Surrey, gazing out onto your back garden.
Well, I
know. With a shed and lots of plants and flowers and trees and a summer house,
Thank
of course,
you.
In your new home, and you think somehow that a Western fits the situation.
Heck yeah, Padre.
Oh,
you see,
yeah.
Try calling someone Padre, you will sound cooler.
I beg to differ.
Just a stranger.
Levels.
Go to Sainsbury's, whatever. Buy your groceries. Thank you, Padre.
Okay, I'm going to Sainsbury's after this.
There you
I'll
go.
Say
Give
and
it
see.
A go.
Yeah.
Only for a man. Doesn't
please,
work women.
Please come and bail me out. Whenever.
Okay. Finally, from Jed. This is the longest email to try and cover. We've got four more of these.
Well, it is. The email itself was quite short. But
exactly.
Then you went off on your weird Western rant.
Jed finally says, and finally do pass the word on to Jen that he's a fan. We will do. We have done, in fact, already. She's quite overwhelmed by it, so much so that she couldn't be here this week.
Yes.
So,
she was going to come, and then the pressure of speaking to her fans. I've all got an email from Daria? One of them. Apologise for mispronouncing your name. Saying, great podcast. I think you've got a great mix. New films, old films, trivia, timelines, and of course, banter. Well, thank you very much.
So far, it's been only banter, really. But we'll get into
that.
That
is true. Well, you mentioned knowing.
That's true.
More films to come, trust me.
More films.
Stick with us. Then he caught the question in episode 20, asking if any other series had made the transition from radio to television to film.
Oh, this is a League of Gentlemen, wasn't it? We picked this one. But actually, yes.
Yeah, with a great example of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Absolutely. I hadn't thought of that one.
Yes, which I always, well, for a while, believed was the book first, then the radio show.
Radio.
Yes, it was the radio first,
yeah,
and then a book, and then TV, and then film.
Yeah.
Which is the plan to make another one?
think they are, yeah.
No, I think they should. Yeah. I caught a bit of it on TV the other day, and was reminded, I do quite like it.
They did a really good recent radio series of sort of the updates of it, which was sort of mostly written after Douglas Adams died. It was, and I caught bits of it. It's really good, and a good cast as well. Excellent stuff.
Barry also says there's a near miss in Amos and Andy, which started on radio, became a film in the 30s, and then came a TV series after that. So not quite the order, but does hit all three.
That's true. So, you know, so they bronze award for Amos and Andy.
Yes. Darryl also mentioned our mentioning of the novel Come Together, and thought we'd like to know if we don't already, that has a sequel, Come Again. I actually did know that, and have read it, which is very good. Yes, it is very good.
Recommended?
Yeah, I think so. It carries on the theme of different points of view by upping the count to four different characters' points of view.
Because this was based on, we were talking about He Said, She Said, wasn't it? Kevin Bacon and Elizabeth Perkins.
Yes. And and Come Together is sort of it's the beginning of a relationship and how it takes its course, yes. with the man and the woman essentially writing alternate chapters, pretty much.
Right.
And Come Again is that it's the same couple with four of their friends. And so the couple are kind of background characters.
Mm.
And it's their four of their friends. I think maybe building up to their wedding, actually.
Okay.
I think it is their wedding. With their four friends. I think it's two men, two women. And written from all their different points of view. So it's just an interesting read. I mean, it's not great literature.
Yeah.
It's a good read in terms of seeing how the same events play out from different points of view.
Certainly, if that is your bag, then I can also recommend the Four Gospels.
Fair enough. Yeah, do they differ radically, though?
What they do is get the days a bit wrong sometimes. Particularly right. John, he's a maverick. He's crazy. Anyway.
biblical tangent.
Yes.
Bible banter, that's exactly.
So thank you, Dara, for your email. Also says, keep up a brilliant podcast. I've left feedback on the iTunes website in Australia, so it may not translate to here.
Yes.
We've been asking for everyone saying, why don't you put your feedback on iTunes?
It could now be that it's of America and Australia. There are thousands of reviews.
Exactly.
And this is Britain. We've got British listeners at all.
Thank you for that. Yes. But anyway, nice to have you listening from the other side of the world. And the final email is from my brother. So thank you, Mark, for getting in touch. This is because I was talking about the film The Peacemaker, which he very kindly, and I don't think I said it this time, but he very kindly got me this as a birthday present.
I don't remember you saying it was kindly.
Ago.
I remember you largely just slagging him off for it.
I think I did, actually. particularly the fact that it was just a blank, well, not a blank tape, just a tape without cover for a cheap video shop down the road.
Blank tape with The Peacemaker written on it.
Pretty much. And the email quite simply says, actually, I seem to recall I made you a rather fetching fake video cover for Peacemaker on VHS. Thank you oh so very much. So thank you, Mark, for writing in. And this is the 21st century way of brothers communicating. One makes a podcast, the other does feedback.
So you don't actually talk to each other
at any point
down the entire line.
Yeah. How's things? There you go. So next time you're on in, you can tell me.
Oh, dear.
Good. So we should get on to some, this year movie history?
Yes. I think we shall. Paul's now diving into the machine.
Don't look.
I'm not. See, this is an advantage of doing it in the new studio, because, well, we used to do a podcast in Paul's living room. Tended to be staring into a corner when I was not looking at your laptop. Whereas now I can just gaze out onto your garden.
Look at the curtain. It's quite exciting.
Well, yes.
Well, the curtain's got flowers on it, so in case you're bored of looking at the garden, you pull the curtains.
It's
flowers.
It's the same. It's pretty much the same thing.
It's actually a painting on the curtain of the garden, so you never need them open, really.
No, I don't see why you bother. Bird in the garden now.
Yeah.
Pave it.
Might do.
Yeah.
In this week in movie history! So, in this week in movie history, April the 1st, 1938, George McFly was born. But what was the film?
It's going to be probably Back to the Future.
Yeah, part two.
I was trying to get the right part.
I see. April the 3rd, 2004. Kate Forster plays in the snow. Her dog Jack is not happy. Yeah, good luck with that one.
Is it a film I should know?
Maybe. You'll have seen it, I think.
Kate Forster.
It's actually a film partly set in the future, but the very, very near future.
No,
it's
don't
called
know.
The Lake House.
Oh, I have seen that.
Sandra Bullock. And
yes, Keanu Reeves.
Keanu Reeves. Yes. Speed.
It's a ridiculous. Yes,
Speed 3.
It's very much not Speed. Yes, it's a very sort of soppy romantic fantasy film.
April the 4th, 1958. Johnny Stomponato is stabbed by Lana Turner's 14-year-old daughter on Academy Awards night as Lana is nominated for Peyton Place. So 1958, we're looking sort of film noir sort of thing.
Yes.
LA.
I'm trying to think of
it's all quite confidential.
Film. Is it LA Confidential?
Correct!
Well, no, that was going to be my song because Lana Turner it gets a mention, but I don't remember.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't remember that instant.
Towards the film.
Uh-huh.
2063, April the 5th, humans make their first contact with the Vulcans.
Star Trek, First Contact.
Absolutely, the clue.
I'm such a geek. First reviews are coming in of Star Trek.
Is that right? Are they going well?
They're apparently looking quite good.
Ooh.
Various critics saying it's a very good mix of old and new.
Yeah.
Sort of updates it. Yeah, probably you're not slavish to the old Trek. Although apparently it does sort of segue into it.
I saw a nice full trailer in the cinema on the weekend, and it's looking good.
Yeah, saying the effects are apparently amazing, and it sort of makes the characters work.
Yeah.
I think because the writers are Star Trek, know Star Trek, and J.J. Abrams knows spectacle. Right. Not Star Trek. So he's not beholden to old Star Trek, but they sort of are.
Mm.
And combined, it apparently works.
Yeah.
So we shall see.
I also saw a trailer in the cinema, the first full trailer, for Bruno.
Oh, yes, Sacha Baron Cohen film. Oh, I've seen that online.
Yeah, and it does look quite funny. I'll be seeing it. It doesn't quite look a Borat. I don't think it's been quite
No,
as good.
It seems to be more embarrassment rather than sort of nice wording.
And also, Borat, I think, is actually really... sympathetic character, and it's in funny situations, but also I think you end up quite liking Borat, and it's a funnier character generally.
Yes.
Whereas Bruno is a lot more about, as you say, just embarrassing other people.
Because Borat is, of course, from Kazakhstan, so he's meant to be not from a Western country.
Yes.
And so he suddenly dropped into situations that nothing's about. Bruno, is Bruno meant to be German?
Yes.
Or something. So he doesn't have the excuse for not sort of understanding lots of stuff.
True.
Because obviously German is a fully developed country. So. Yeah, I can see why that wouldn't quite work
True.
As well.
But
it does look
it.
Funny,
look
yes.
To it. Yeah,
especially the footage of him at the proper fashion show, covered in a Velcro suit, falling out on stage, and everyone in the crowd just going slightly quiet and wondering what's going on.
I like the fact that he's when he's looking for a locksmith, when he's handcuffed to someone else in bondage gear, going up to the people who are holding the God Hates Fag signs outside of Church of America.
It's brave.
Having seen the documentaries covering those people, they don't really generally like the homosexual community at the
best
of times.
Not big senses of humour.
Exactly. They're not going to laugh riotously at that film when it comes out. 1967, April the 7th. Zombie apocalypse begins as the living dead begin to rise and devour the flesh of the living.
What year was that?
1967.
Dawn of the Dead?
No, Night it's going to be Night of the Living Dead. That's the fella. So there you go. That was In This Week in Movie History. We should get on to a review then, shall we?
I think we should.
We're long overdue it. So let's do The Boat That Rocked.
Fair
and
enough.
Then we'll move on to the niceness.
Because you want to warm up your ranting muscles.
Exactly. The Boat That Rocked is the new Richard Curtis film, who I like.
Yes.
I should say, start off by saying that I like Richard Curtis.
Because after the first trailer I saw for this, I sort of thought, it looks like a fairly average British comedy. And I think either I missed Richard Curtis or his name wasn't on it. And then I saw another trailer, which had a new film from Richard Curtis. And immediately I thought, oh, right, okay,
exactly.
Now I'm more
interested. Yeah. You're on board, so to speak, with the boating metaphor.
Nice.
I like Richard Curtis, particularly as a writer. He has directed Love Actually, which I thought was good. A bit over-sentimental, but watchable and likeable, good ensemble piece. He's another ensemble piece with The Boat That Rocked. And I like him. I like the cast. It's got Bill Nighy in it. It's got Nick Frost. It's got that bloke off the IT Crowd. Kenneth Branagh's in it. Jack Davenport's in it. Rhys Darby's in it, which I'm delighted by, because he's the guy who's in the boss in Yes Man, and he's in Flight of the Conchords as a manager.
Is Jack Davenport, much like Pirates of the Caribbean, playing a fairly straight character
which
doesn't make use of his quite impressive comic skills?
Pretty much, yes.
That's rubbish.
But no, I hated it. I thought it absolutely sucked. I thought it was the boat that definitely did not rock. It sucked mighty ass. And can we say that? I don't know.
Yeah, we can.
I will.
That's right.
I just really, I was there waiting. It was light. It was not funny. It was light. And I was sat there waiting to laugh.
Yeah.
And I didn't laugh.
Because Love Actually has proper jokes in it.
Exactly.
And humour.
And we know Richard Curtis can do jokes. He wrote Blackadder.
Yeah.
You know, he's proved himself.
Mm.
Four Weddings and a Funeral, one of my favourite, it's my favourite romantic comedy. We've had this on Desert Island Flicks before. Mm. I really enjoy his stuff. And it just seemed like he was coasting, again, to use another boating metaphor.
Yeah.
But I just didn't like it. And I walked out. I don't walk out of films ever. And I got halfway through and I just thought, I've given it a chance and it's not doing it for me. And I think I think if it was actually a lesser director and lesser stars, I'd probably have given it the benefit of the doubt and stayed just to see if it turned at the end. And I'm sure it got better as well. I'm sure that they were having all the silly setup and the more interesting plot line would have come in. Because I think apparently Emma Thompson's in it, which I never stuck around to see. But if it was a different director or different stars, I would have probably stuck around. It was the fact that I saw these actors who I like and I enjoy their work normally. And it's the director and writer who I normally enjoy.
Yeah. When it's a combination of things and people that you think they should be able to do so much better.
Exactly. And I just thought, I don't want to see that. If this is what they're doing, fair play to them. Not themselves out, but it's not for me.
Yeah.
And I don't normally like to predict how films are going to do, but I think this has got flop written all over it.
Mm.
I just don't think the nation will get behind this. I think, actually, I reckon it may have also been affected by the Slumdog Millionaire effect, in that now people have had a nice feel-good movie, and if they go along thinking... normally Richard Curtis' film would do that.
Yeah.
And we just had a really good one, so I think people might go along and think, well, it's light, but it's not...
Yeah, so
Love
it's
not Four Weddings.
Yeah, so it doesn't have quite... It's not as deep as Slumdog Millionaire is, but it's not funny either.
No.
So it ends up just being sub-everything.
Exactly. So it's a big shame that it just didn't really connect for me. Although the other thing that I could maybe blame my walkout on, maybe it wasn't in quite a good mood because of this as well, But, you know, I've talked in previous weeks about things I've smuggled into cinemas.
Oh, yes.
Kebabs, Subway subs, barbecues, the like, the works. I smuggled something new in this week.
Cocaine?
No, it wasn't cocaine. Okay. It was a couple of marks down from cocaine.
Right,
a couple. Beer!
Hey, oh, really?
It was the 11 o'clock showing of this film, and I'd just come straight from a gig, and it was a gig where they give you free booze. And oh, nice. So I had some in my bag, and I'd come straight from there, had it in my bag, and I thought, I'm thirsty. Got a beer in my bag, I've got a bottle and a key ring, there's no one else really around me in the cinema. Let's have a beer!
Hey, why not?
It's 11 o'clock at night, and I'm in a strange city. Why not? So, yeah, I cracked one open, so to speak.
No, he said open, not off. That's
off, that's a different cinema. Yes. Yeah, so well, I finished my beer, and then I just left. So maybe it's just, you know, maybe you should. Maybe this is why you shouldn't drink and watch films. Because you start to think you've got an opinion
but
that
arguably,
over the cinema.
If you once you had a beer, you'd be even more inclined to laugh at something that wasn't that funny.
Oh, maybe.
So if you're still not laughing, then...
I think I just got angry. So oh, I'm throwing it at the screen. Well, come on, Richard Curtis, I'll show you.
Yeah, but you're not someone who generally tends to get angry after one beer.
Maybe I'll...
It's not really in your nature.
Maybe I'll try this again. I'll go into different films. Go on, Bolt! Run, Bolt! Run across America! You can do it! Monsters versus aliens! Monsters! Who's it gonna be? Monsters! Monsters!
Come on, aliens! Come on, aliens!
Come on, Kate Winslet! Read! Read, Kate! You're the queen of the world!
I should say to people, we've not been drinking now.
Exactly,
we're just.
Yeah. Well, I think drunken heckling of films is the future.
I think it does work. I enjoy the concept. I'm also pleased when people come out, if they walk out of a film early and they say, oh, it was awful, so I refuse to watch it. Generally, my attitude would be, well, you can't comment on the film because you haven't seen the whole film.
Yes.
But you're not doing that. Yeah, you're not condemning the film overall. You're just saying that it's obvious. Everyone could do so much better.
Yeah.
And you just weren't enjoying it.
No,
so I wasn't. Out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The plot line of the film is that there is a vague plot line. It's about pirate radio, and it's about a young kid who has been sent off to his uncle, which is Bill Nye,
yes.
To reform because he's been caught, I think, drinking and... no, he's been caught smoking in school.
Right.
Cigarettes and spliffs. And his mother says, you go and stay with your uncle on this boat and he'll sort you out. And, of course, Bill Nye there goes, well, that's not going to happen. We're going to have a bit of a rebellious, you know, 60s craziness here. And I left at the end of this set piece where he's trying to seduce this girl and it doesn't work out for various reasons. And I just ended up thinking, oh, that's just a bit sad, really. And it's meant to be a hilarious set piece and he just didn't get the girl he was after for various reasons. And that's... not funny.
So it wasn't even an amusing or hilarious failure.
Not really. No, I think because it was meant to be, and it just didn't quite deliver. Really.
No.
I think the other thing that I don't like about it is I should point out I hate the poster as well.
What is the poster?
It's like the eight or so of these ensemble people, the cast, all in a different coloured sort of box, looking crazy and 60s and a bit like Austin Powers and pointing and going, "Ooh, yeah, we're cool and funky and crazy." And what I don't like about this film is that. It starts off by saying, these are these pirate DJs, they're mavericks, they're maniacs, they're crazy, the whole nation is listening to them, and we're told that they're really cool. But you look at the screen and you go, well, you're not cool, you're Nick Frost. And, you know, he's funny sometimes, not in this film, but he's, you know, can be a funny actor. He's not cool, though. You wouldn't look at him and say, you're cool.
No, he's funny through his sort of slight, almost through his lack of cool.
Exactly. And so I just didn't believe it. And I'm there watching it going, okay, you're telling me in the script these people are cool, but I need to be shown it.
Yeah.
And I felt it's like watching Ocean's 11 with a cast of people who aren't George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon and so on. They are just people, just actors who aren't cool.
Yes.
And Ocean's 11 works because you know that they are cool and they're doing this big...
But also, I mean, obviously the actors are great, but in the film it doesn't start off by saying, look at these cool people, everyone loves them.
Yeah.
It leads you into it and say,
exactly.
You know, these are these people doing cool stuff,
yeah.
And so we can see they're cool.
Yeah, it's showing, not telling, really. It's that simple. I did feel I was told this, you know, you must like these people and all this, you know, this crazy mid-60s pirate radio vibe that is sweeping the nation, and I just didn't really feel that.
Yeah.
And then I was at least watching it, thinking, okay, well, but if this is a historical, you know, part of history and I'm learning something, fair enough. But then found out afterwards that he's made up pretty much everything.
Oh, right.
It's about a pirate ship that didn't exist. The things that went on there are all made up as well. The characters are pretty much made up. It's not that much based on truth.
Right.
Even though they had a couple of advisors from Johnny Walker from Radio 2, because he was on the pirate radio ship himself. So, you know, they had their advisors, but it's all pretty much fictionalised. So it's not even like you're watching a snapshot of history.
Yeah.
It's just like you're watching a snapshot of Richard Curtis's career that I wish he'd forget and move on and make something nice again.
No, but, fair enough.
So, yeah.
Well, yeah, it's one of those, I mean, if someone wants to go and see it that I know, I'll almost certainly go and see it.
Yeah.
But I'm no longer.
I'd be curious to know what you think.
Driven to go and see it.
You'll probably think it's better than I'm giving it credit
possibly.
For.
Possibly. It may be another. After a beer, what sort of lightweight are you? It may be another Wedding Singer in the, a
maybe,
film that you
maybe.
Just irrationally hate. Except from the sound of it, this isn't irrational hatred. It sort of seems entirely justifiable. Whereas The Wedding Singer, I think, is irrational. Because there's not much, because you seem to really hate The Wedding Singer, and there's not that much to really hate.
Yes.
Whereas this just seems, it's just a massive disappointment.
Yeah, it was.
You're like an annoyed parent. I'm not angry,
yes.
Just disappointed.
You've let yourself
which,
down.
Which is worse,
you've
really.
Let the ship down, you've let your castmates down.
So that's the boat we rocked.
The boat that didn't
which
rock.
Should have sunk.
And the other film I saw this weekend was Duplicity.
Ah, yes, which I'm very, very keen to see.
Yeah, it's okay. It's the prequel to Multiplicity with Michael Keaton, and it's the sequel to Dark City.
I don't know.
And Duplicity is a film. One word.
Sounds like duplicity, yeah.
Good. Okay. We've done an audio charade for that day. Good. It's Clive Owen and Julie Roberts, so it's half of Closer. thankfully, it's not Closer, because
right.
That was a weird film.
Oh, that was very good, but it's a fairly traumatic
film. It is a bit.
Anyway.
It was like a play on screen, and I didn't really
well, it
see
is,
that.
Yeah.
Duplicity, it's lots of double-crossing. It's two ex-spies who are now part of this corporate world, which we're sort of told exists in this film, but don't quite buy it, really. It's that these big multinational companies hire ex-spies
to plant them
in other companies and then learn secrets.
I find that quite easy to believe, personally.
I don't know. I mean,
there's all sorts of corporate. I mean, yeah, there's things like, I think, someone was arrested not too long ago for trying to sell Pepsi the Coke formula or something like that.
Right.
And with the McLaren Formula One team, they were in possession of Ferrari stuff a couple
of years
ago.
I could believe that, but what I didn't quite believe is that both of these two big rival companies, who are the two biggest in this field, we're told in the film, fake, of course, you know, it just shows the film, we're told that these people both hire these spies and put them in and get them to do it. So they're both as complicit as each other.
Right.
You know, I can believe there are spies who will do that, who will go and steal things and then try and sell them to other people. What I can't quite believe is that it's like Coke actually planting 10 spies in Pepsi and Pepsi's planting 10 spies in Coke and then trying to find out what each other's doing.
It's a bit too contrived.
I didn't quite believe that. So actually that is one sort of underlying problem with it I found, is I didn't quite get behind that, so it took it difficult to take the rest seriously. Although you're not meant to take it seriously. It's meant to be a romp. It's meant to be... it's sort of like Charade, which is... Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn meets, I suppose, a bit of Bourne as well.
It seemed to be the civilian version of Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
A bit of that as well, yeah. It's sort of light-hearted romp where every scene, you don't quite know. It changes every scene. Who's on which side? Who's double-crossing who? Are they cheating on each other? Are they cheating together? Are they spies who are working together and will eventually double-cross each other? Are they double-crossing someone else? Treble-crossing, quadruple-crossing? It goes on and on.
Yeah.
As a result, I found it quite difficult to get behind.
Yes.
Because that means that you're entirely hanging everything on the two characters' chemistry.
Right.
Because that's all you have.
Because you're
left.
Never really invested in...
Yeah, exactly. You don't know whether you should be supporting that one or that one. Because you don't know who's the goodie, who's the baddie.
Yeah.
Are they both goodies, both baddies? Who knows?
I suppose it's a problem because it's not like it's a film which follows a linear plot and then suddenly pulls the rug out from under you.
Mm.
If you know the rug is constantly being spun around,
there's a rug
you're just not
going to
try and stand on it.
Exactly, exactly. Yes, exactly.
I'm quite pleased with that message.
Oh, that's good. That worked. But so that is the problem. So all you have left is the chemistry between Julia Roberts and Clive Owen, which was half there, I felt.
Okay. what, is it just Julia Roberts?
Julia
Roberts had loads of chemistry. Clive Owen didn't have any.
It was okay, but I just don't think... And, you know, they are pretty good. They are pretty good. And it's a script that... I know Julia Roberts has said in an interview that it's a script that you need a good actor to deliver it well because it's quite written lines. It's the writer... who wrote the Bourne films as well.
Oh, yes.
So he has got this sort of background in there.
Hey, wasn't it... is it director of Michael Clayton as well?
Yeah, director of Michael Clayton as well.
Which I thought was quite wordy.
And it is quite similar.
Could have been bogged down.
Exactly. It is quite similar in that sense. And he's trying to make this film like a sort of charade, an old-fashioned Cary Grant sort of film, which, as a result, is therefore very wordy and very much lots of smart, sassy dialogue. As a result, you need a good actor to carry it off, and both of them... I think carry it off pretty well. The only thing you do therefore need really, if you're going to try and make it like a Cary Grant film, is you need a Cary Grant, or you need someone special. You need to look at it and go, wow, that is an absolute film superstar delivering that, and I will watch every word. Like, you know, an Audrey Hepburn or someone like that, Humphrey Bogart. It feels like it needs someone of that character.
And neither of them quite had it.
No.
They're both very good.
Yeah.
You know, lots of history, both capable of excellent stuff. But yes, neither of them are... I mean, well, Julia Roberts without, I mean, not even an age-related thing, but she just hasn't been around as much in recent years. No. So she's not quite an enormous star anymore.
Yeah.
And Clive Owen is very good and been lots of good stuff. Yeah. But yeah, neither of them quite, while they may once have done, don't have huge star power.
No. I feel George Clooney probably could have carried it off, maybe.
Yeah, but then it's probably a bit too Ocean's
Eleven.
It's quite
Ocean's
Eleven,
exactly. It is, really. Or equally, but then I'm thinking like a young Sean Connery. But that if you start having to think that actor reduced by 30 years might do it, that's sort of the sort of person they're looking for this film. I just don't know if there's the actors around who could have carried this film off. Having said that, you know, it's a good enough film, enjoyable to a point, but, you know, you do get a bit dizzy from having that rug swept under you a little too many times. So that's my only criticism.
Okay, so it's definitely worth a watch, but just slightly qualified.
Yeah,
but
a little bit qualified, yeah.
Should we move on to DVDs?
Let's do that.
Leading off with Lost in La Mancha.
Oh, yes.
Which is a documentary about Terry Gilliam's failed, disaster-bound attempt to film Don Quixote, or was it The Man Who Killed Don Quixote?
That's right, yes.
Which was a few years ago, he tried to make this, and partly the film star got quite ill, partly they had to work with half the budget they wanted, partly the weather came in and destroyed
good,
lots of stuff.
It did feel like God was destroying it.
Yeah, it was just, the film was cursed from the get-go. And, I mean, it's a very interesting film to watch in terms of what goes on in the making of a film and how it all comes together, and also how just a few things going wrong can cause serious problems, especially when your budget's on such a tight restraint.
Yes.
As soon as things go wrong and they need to get the insurance to pay out, and then they realise that certain things aren't covered, certain things are covered, it's going to take time, and they just end up, they pretty, I think someone's saying that some films wind down and this just hit a brick wall.
Yeah.
The whole thing, it just slams to a stop, and they think, we can't go on, we've just got to shut it down.
I found it quite a sad watch when I saw it, really.
It is.
You're there thinking, you're wishing him on, really, and you can just see that it's
never
going to work.
Yeah, and he's been longing to make it for years, and now I think all the footage, we see clips of the footage they shot, and only little tiny bits, because they didn't get all that long. But you can see it working. And there's one very funny bit of Johnny Depp railing against a fish.
Right.
And yeah, it just could all work. And you see Terry Gilliam's passion behind it, but it's just doomed and so it falls apart. And so this was, I think it was meant to be a documentary pretty much for the DVD, so the making of this film. And as it went on, they just realised, oh dear, no, it's all going wrong.
Yeah.
So I think they just had all the footage and thought, okay, we'll just use this instead. Also, because I think the insurance company owns the rights to all the proper film footage.
Right.
And so as such, the documentary stuff is all that's around.
Yeah, and they've made something from it.
Well, yeah.
By making the DVD.
So it's definitely, it's worth a watch.
Yeah.
But it's just, I mean, it's interesting to watch, and it's very entertaining. But it is quite sad.
Yeah.
But very soon after that happened, and it all shut down, he then recruited more investors, and he's now trying to make it again.
It looks like it's going to happen.
Well, hopefully so,
or if not, it's Lost in La Mancha 2.
Yes.
This time it's war.
But yes, it's definitely worth a watch, if you can seek it out. And does tie in to this week's Desert Island Flicks.
Indeed, yes.
And it is going to be the best Terry Gilliam film.
Right.
Or Terry Gilliam directed film.
Yes, indeed, yes.
Which there's lots of. And Terry Gilliam, he tends to not even divide people, but he's a very distinctive filmmaker.
Well, he's really one of the few modern auteurs, I would say.
Yeah, very true.
Arty film theory sort of way.
But it's true, he has a distinct visual style. And I mean, he's one of the directors who, if you say a Terry Gilliam film,
you know what
you're going to get,
exactly.
Or sort of, at least the kind of thing you're going to get.
Certainly.
And there aren't that many directors
I
who
do
can
enjoy
be set off.
And I always look out for his new releases.
Yes.
And normally they're in the cinema for about a week. He's in a very small art house place.
Yeah.
Which is
criminally unfair.
It is. But yeah, so we'll come back to that at the end of the episode. And in the meantime, why not think of your favourite Terry Gilliam film?
Yeah.
Email us in.
Yeah. Which we won't read before we get to ours.
No, because that will be difficult.
Yeah,
yes.
It's
podcast@moviemistakes.com if you'd like to get in touch with the show about anything.
Anything at all.
Whatsoever.
Whatever you fancy. Also on DVD this week, I saw Dark City.
Oh, yes.
Which I bought the director's cut. And I do have the non-director's cut somewhere, but it turns out not on my shelf.
Oh,
so I've lent it to someone. But whoever's got it, you can now keep it, because I've got the director's cut.
Lethal Weapon 2 somewhere, probably.
Somewhere, yeah. Lethal Weapon 2. Yeah, sorry. Lethal Weapon 2 is another DVD I've got the director's cut of, and has vanished somewhere. Which is really odd, because none of my friends would borrow Lethal Weapon 2 off me.
I reckon you've got another shelf somewhere you've forgotten about.
Quite possibly.
Maybe your DVD shelves are so full of DVDs, they're actually falling into the ground.
That's
and actually the person in the flat below has now got a shelf just at the very top.
I did wonder where all of like L to S had gone.
There you are.
That's bizarre.
It's downstairs.
Yeah.
That's where it is.
I'll go down and ask.
Mrs. Jones down, the 90-year-old. Oh, Dark City's very good.
Anyway, but Dark City, if you've not seen it, it was made in 1998, just before The Matrix. And in fact, The Matrix even reused one or two sets from it. And the premise is we don't actually know too much about it, so I won't ruin too much. Mm. Essentially, there a man wakes up in a bath in a hotel room with a dead prostitute in the room.
Right.
He doesn't know how she got there, what's gone on. It's nighttime. The city seems to stay permanently dark. There are weird people moving around.
How does he know she's a prostitute if she's dead?
Oh, that's a good point. Well, we know she's a prostitute. We find out she's a prostitute with a dead woman in the flat. And it's essentially just him working out what's gone on. Mm. And I mean, lots of it unfolds quite quickly, and you get to see what's going on. But I don't want to ruin it for you because it goes quite interesting.
Well, it's a mystery, isn't it? In a way, it's a mystery. Sci-fi pretty much. Thing.
Yeah, and there was an opening voiceover by Kiefer Sutherland in the original, which the studio apparently insisted on putting in, which spells out a lot of the setup. And then sort of spoils the surprise of a few revelations later on. Mm. And so the director's cut has lost that completely.
Right.
And so now you just watch the film and just, you know, you discover things as the characters do, which makes it a lot more interesting. And it's just a very interesting film and worth a watch.
I think I saw half of the film, and then but it was really late at night, and I think I just had to go or fell asleep or something, and just I was enjoying it, but just thought I must see the end of it.
No.
And I never did, actually.
Okay. So I'll lend it to you. Yeah, it definitely is. It's again... I mean, well, it's by Alex Proyas, who did Knowing.
Yes.
And The Crow. It does have parallels to Knowing, I think, it could be perceived as being sort of silly and a bit preposterous, but it's all
but
taken seriously. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It all hangs together, provided you stick with the premise. And yeah, it's a very, very interesting watch.
Yeah. I saw a film on DVD this week I've been waiting for ages to see, which was The Mist.
Ah, yes.
Which is a Frank Darabont directed film who directed various Stephen King efforts, including The Green Mile and the Shawshank Redemption. So he's known for doing these sort of Stephen King films which aren't the sci-fi horror ones.
Yeah.
You know, he's done the human interest ones, the Green Mile and Shawshank.
Yes.
The Mist is, therefore, it's the first horror film he's directed, I think, of Stephen King's. But it does have that interesting background of the human interest story.
Right.
And I think it's one of the better horror films I think I've ever seen. Probably,
okay.
Because of that fact that it has got good scares in it. And in fact, Frank Darabont is proudest of the fact that when Stephen King watched it, he jumped out of his seat.
Nice.
So he scared Stephen King. He's happy. He can die happy now. But it has got scares in it. But also, it's got a really good dynamic of human interest people. Because the idea is, it's a bit like The Fog, John Carpenter, and so on anyway. But in that, but down a bit, The Mist. It's not quite. It's just a little mist.
Exactly. You can see through it more.
The drizzle, you know what I mean? Yeah. But what it is, it's a small community in Maine, Kelsa Breeze, Stephen King. There are places outside of Maine.
Yeah,
he doesn't know it.
No. Who needs them?
And they're all in this big supermarket, and this mist comes in, and people suddenly are thinking, oh, it's just a mist. And then a guy runs in and says, don't go in the mist. There's a guy out, you know, a guy out that was in there and was suddenly dragged away by something. We don't know what it was. Whatever it is, just stay in here till the mist is gone. So they start on that premise. And then slowly realize, you know, people, of course, are saying, it's only a mist, come on. And then I think that typical thing is, okay, let's see what happens when you go outside then. Oh, you shouldn't. So there's a lot of that throughout. But then it's more about the Blitz spirit and more about the people inside trying to cope for a good couple of days. And there's a really interesting angle on this. There's a religious zealot inside and a really interesting plot dynamic of how she actually turns a lot of the people in there to, you know, when people think it's their big end, that's when they start turning to different, you know, religions or fanatics in different ways. Mm. And she sort of converts people. And our protagonists are slowly looking at this and thinking, we've got to get out of here before, you know, she's going to sacrifice one of us. That's what it's coming to, really, you know, to try and, you know, appease the beast or whatever it is out there. I'll be honest, there is a couple of laughable moments of when we first see the thing that's in the mist.
Right.
And they're thinking, oh, really? Don't show us the monster. You know, there's a good rule of, like, the Cloverfield rule. Don't show us the monster. And they do, and you're thinking, oh, that's just quite pathetic.
No, because at least in the fog, it's sort of an army of sort of pirates or smugglers.
Yeah,
undead people.
Yeah, yeah.
So if it's some sort of beast creature thing.
Exactly. But
if
you can get over the first look of the beast, the nice thing about it is there is, I mean, the explanation of why there's this beast there, I think, is very, very hokey, and just get past that very quickly.
Yeah.
But there is this nice idea of different sorts of beasts and monsters out there. And so actually, you never see the same one twice.
Okay.
So the first one you see, you go, ooh, okay, is that it? Rubbish. But then, and what's very interesting, and I don't think I'm giving anything away about this, is that throughout the film, they get bigger.
Right.
And so it starts quite small, and then it gets bigger, and the final one you see is effing huge. And you go, they're going, wow, that's, I'm freaked out now watching that. It's pretty good. And the other thing to say about The Mist is the ending is a phenomenal sort of fall off your seat going, moment. It's a classic ending of a horror film, because a lot of horror films don't know how to end their films, and it's the final shock, and you think it's fine, but actually it isn't, sort of thing. And they found a really good way of ending it.
So it's not just sort of a final big scare?
No.
Okay.
No, it's really, and it's worth a look, again, because it's more of a human interest thing than, it has got horror in it, but it is about this human story.
Yeah.
And they find a really good way of ending it that is quite satisfying. And actually, it wasn't in the book. They couldn't work out how to end it in the film adaptation. And Frank Darabont said to Stephen King, can I end it this way? And Stephen King said, I wish I'd thought of that. That is the way it should have ended. And in fact, and this is what I found out afterwards, that although I thought CGI was all very hokey in...
Well, when was it made? I want to say about 95.
You know, it's about 4 years ago.
Oh, right, so it's quite
very recent. Yeah,
oh, okay.
Got really good cast. Toby Jones is in it, my old teacher.
Ah, yes.
Others.
So I think in my mind it's sort of around the same time as The Fog because it's one of those films I've known very little about. I've just known the title and I think I just always assumed it was a rip off of The Fog or vice versa and not thought about it beyond that.
It was William Sadler's in it. Really good cast actually. They're really what good actors they've got for it. But when Frank Darabont settled on this ending of the film before they'd started filming it, he took it to I think it was Dimension Films, the Weinsteins.
Yes.
And
who did Scream?
Yes, indeed. And he said to them, you know, I've had a few offers in this film, but I want you guys to make it. The deal is that I will bring it in under budget if you let me have the ending that I want. And don't change the ending. Because he knew full well they'd try and change the ending, which they would have done.
Yeah.
And the Weinsteins went, fair enough. If you bring it in under budget, you can have your ending. And that's why the CGI is quite rubbish.
Okay.
And having found that out afterwards, I appreciated it more. Because at the time I was watching it thinking, you should have spent more on the CGI. But balancing it up, thinking... more on the CGI or that ending. I'm glad they've got that ending and bad CGI.
Because the ending is presumably what stays with you.
Yeah, exactly. So watch it with that in mind, that excuse the bad CGI.
Yeah. Knowing sometimes a low budget is worth having.
Knowing that the screenplay is therefore intact. So it's worth a look. Really, really worth a look.
No, very good. A film which actually ties into, sort of 2000, I think it's 2002, is The Imposter, which came on TV today. And I'd not heard of at all, but just sort of flicked around and saw The Imposter, a film starring Gary Sinise. And I thought, because I'm so used to him in CSI New York now. I almost forget that he's done lots of films. So flick this on, and it's based on a Philip K. Dick story.
Okay.
I think, did we run down a while ago?
We did.
There are so many stories of his that have become film. I mean, it was around the same time as Minority Report, but I don't remember it in cinemas at all, so it's clearly a low budget, possibly straight to DVD something. And the premise here is sort of set in the future. Gary Sinise is a sort of high-ranking government scientist man who gets approached, or pretty much arrested very early on in the film, by a government group who is set up to prevent humanity being attacked by aliens. Or these aliens exist. We know there is a war going on. And they take him into custody and say, no, we know that you're a clone. Ooh. And you've been replaced. You're sort of a bioengineered clone by these aliens. You've got a bomb in your chest. And you're going to find the chancellor or the ambassador or someone and blow yourself up and kill him. He goes, no, I'm not. I'm a normal person. I'm a scientist.
I'm just a bloke.
What are you talking about? And then they show him footage of someone else screaming, saying, no, I'm just this man. What are you doing? With this device reaching into his chest and ripping out his heart. This man screaming, protesting his innocence right the way through. And then suddenly his heart sort of unfolds and you see this bioengineered bomb in it.
Ooh.
So we realise these clones do exist.
Yes.
But the whole film, well, the majority of the film, is essentially Gary Sinise convinced of knowing, no, I'm innocent. I'm just a normal man. Mm. They've got mistaken identity. These people being convinced he is a clone, him on the run, and then he starts to think, oh, well, how would I know?
Course,
maybe I could be the clone, but I wouldn't know. So trying to find evidence either way and work out when he might have been replaced.
Yeah.
And then we start finding out bits and pieces about how it could go either way and what went on and who, might there be another clone?
Interesting.
And so it's just quite an interesting bit of a sort of futuristic thriller.
Yeah.
Ideas.
He's quite good at those sort of things.
Yeah, and it's an interesting film and sort of not particularly high budget, but it's just a very competent, interesting film that was surprising evening viewing for me. Just flicking around, thought, oh, that'll do, and it was a good watch. Also watched Superman Returns this week.
So this is the more recent Superman film, isn't it? Christopher Reeve era.
No, this is 2006.
Okay,
I'm slightly conflicted because it's very good. The effects are good. It's Superman, and Superman as a cinematic concept is still good. I think it still carries a lot of weight.
Yeah.
It's still good visuals of a bloke in a suit flying around, laser beams out of his eyes, invulnerable to stuff, and so that all works. Brandon Routh, I thought, was quite good. Play Superman. Kevin Spacey's Lex Luthor is brilliantly cast.
Yes. Yeah, that's good.
So that all works, but it's hampered by Kate Bosworth plays Lois Lane.
Okay.
And I mean, she can act. So nothing against her, but she's not Lois Lane. Lois Lane is meant to be kind of a feisty, go-getting, sort of slightly irritating but good reporter.
Terry Hatcher, basically.
That's the thing. Terry Hatcher.
She nailed it.
Or in fact, in Smallville, Erica Durant.
okay.
plays Lois Lane. She's come in the last few series. She's appeared as a character. And it's and they both, and in fact Margot Kidder as well, they all hit it perfectly in terms of just making that character. You can believe she could be a brilliant reporter.
Yes.
Whereas Kate Bosworth is just a little bit flat and just a bit and a bit droopy.
Yeah.
And well, no, not droopy, but she just doesn't have the spark that you
certainly
need.
In any film I've seen her in, she looks good, but can't really. She
yeah,
looks
there's
the
no.
Look, she can't act the act.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And so she's a bit bland. And also the concept, Lex Luthor is essentially trying to destroy most of America by creating a new island, which will swamp America, but then he will own the land so he can sell it. Which is sort of a ridiculous Lex Luthor plan, but it doesn't quite hold together. And the way Superman foils his plan at the very end. It's a little bit too much. Yeah, so there's good and bad about it.
Yeah.
And I want to like it more than I do, but I do still like it a lot, but there's enough little wrong bits in there.
Yeah, I never saw it for that reason, really. I sort of read reviews at the time that said it hasn't quite got it right.
I think because it's part a reboot, but part it's a sequel to Superman 2. They've ignored 3 and 4.
Oh, right.
I don't think even 3 and 4 actually changed all that much, but they just ignored them. And Superman has been away for 5 years and has come back, so the world has moved on a bit. But it's set in modern times rather than being that.
Has it got the Superman theme in it by John
it does,
Williams?
Yes.
Hey.
I think it's Brian Singer directed it, who said that he wouldn't do it without that music,
yeah,
which
course.
Is fair enough.
Yeah.
So it's a weird one because I think they probably should have done a proper reboot, but they now can't really reboot it because they've sort of half rebooted it.
True.
But there's talk of a new one, but it's a little bit in limbo.
I think they should do Supergirl Returns.
I quite like seeing a new Supergirl film, mainly because I like the costume.
Who would you cast a Supergirl in Supergirl Returns?
Ooh.
Not Kate Bosworth.
Not Kate Bosworth. I don't know, you'd need someone's a young, decently blonde...
Heather Graham.
Maybe, actually.
I could see that working in the suit.
Yeah, but I think Supergirl should be a bit younger, though.
Not against
Heather Graham, not that she's too... I mean, she's young in lots of ways, but... I think that's why Helen Slater was quite good, because she was probably 20-something, early 20.
Something like that, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm not sure who's up and coming.
Yes, okay. Well, if you have an idea, why not email us in?
Yes,
podcast@moviemistakes.com with who should play Supergirl in Supergirl Returns.
Yes.
Because we're going to make it. Oh, yeah. We'll call her up. We'll get our agents to talk to their people.
Oh, yes. Budget of £2.50.
Exactly. I'm sure
easy.
For that.
Actually, one of our friends has the Supergirl costume.
Really? Oh, yes, she does, doesn't she?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, she should do it.
Yeah. Oh, she could. Anyway. We digress.
Onward.
Sorry. Yes. One last thing. Reading up on Superman Returns, one of many films I'm pining for that was never made and never will be made. And apparently in 1993 or maybe later, there was a script. It began to be produced as well. Then the plug got pulled for some reason. New Superman film, mid-90s, written by Kevin Smith. There is a script called Superman Lives, which I think I had once, but I haven't read. Mm. It's apparently very good.
Mm.
And was going to be directed by Tim Burton.
Wow.
I may have combined two
that
things there, actually. There definitely is a Kevin Smith script.
Yes.
The Tim Burton film, Superman, was, I think, greenlit. There was even a poster with like the Superman sort of embossed silver logo saying, come in 98. Those may be two separate things. Tim Burton may not be filming that script. But a Tim Burton Superman, I'd love to see
that. That would
have worked, wouldn't it? Oh, that would be so good. But yes, unfortunately not to be.
From one vaguely surrealist sci-fi fantasy auteur director to another, Terry Gilliam.
Ah, yes.
Desert Island Flicks, just to round it off. Favourite Terry Gilliam film from his canon? What would you say?
The Terry Gilliam canon.
Yeah.
That's good, yeah. I am going to go with 12 Monkeys.
Good choice.
Sort of solid joy. I mean, it's not quite as overly visual as some of his films, but I remember the main thing that sticks with me about it, partly it's great, generally, Bruce Willis, Brad Pitt, sci-fi, futuristic, time-travel-y thing. The main thing that sticks with it is when I saw it with, I think, you and a couple of other people
back in the day. That's right, yeah.
I think we all, there probably about 5 or 6 of us, all came out of the cinema with different interpretations of what the ending was.
I see, yes, yeah. It was clever for that, actually.
Because of the ending, the way it plays out, you could take it a variety of different ways.
Yeah.
And I think between how many of us there were, we pretty much covered all of
it. It was an intelligent time travel film, which was quite nice. I like the fact that it... And I went in knowing nothing about it and came out really enjoying it. So, that was a really good film.
And also Brad Pitt showing a bit of range as well.
Yeah,
and also actually Bruce Willis showing a bit of range beyond Die Hard.
Yeah, that was interesting, that. I feel that the best Terry Gilliam film, I've got to say Brazil.
Ah, yes.
It's just, and I look at the other ones, and obviously, 12 Monkeys, very good. Time Bandits, even Baron Munchausen, I got a soft spot for.
Yeah. I think it was a box office failure,
exactly,
but that doesn't make it a bad film.
But I look at all of those, and even actually, the you know, he you know, he co-directed Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yes.
Although that's not really indicative of film as such. But yeah. Even after all that, looking at all of that, I think Brazil is the epitome of
which
the Guinness film.
Yet another classic great film I just haven't
seen. We'll add that to Schindler's List. Yes. And what was the other one you had to watch as well?
Can't remember. Something else.
But no, I think it's just lovely. He's got a really well put together world. Really good cast. Jonathan Pryce, excellent lead role. It's sort of this panicked... really good soundtrack. Michael Palin, brilliant, being cast against type. Was this sort of torturous dentist. Robert De Niro is in it.
Yes.
Bob Hoskins is in it. Really good cast, and funny at times, scary at times. And this, you know, I think if, in terms of future dystopian films as well, I think it's probably the ultimate. So Brazil gets my vote.
Fair enough. Justifiable. I think we're done.
On that bombshell.
Yes.
Let us leave you. Until the next time, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
As ever, podcast@moviemistakes.com.
Yes.
That's the email address.
Which really, we should probably set up a Movie Banter address.
We should get a little website.
We could do.
Maybe do that.
We'll discuss that.
Facebook fan page.
We'll discuss that off air. Yes. Yeah. No, that's very true.
But in the meantime, you can Twitter us up and find us there.
Yes. I think that's it.
Yeah.
I think that's all of the new media options available to you.
Exactly.
Podcast, email, Twitter. For the moment.
Exactly.
We'll cover more bases.
Whatever new one comes out, we'll join you.
Oh, yes.
So, till next time, farewell.
Farewell.